Okay, it's recording. Are these people not here? Jay, did you quit? And Nicholas Bowling?
That was mine, I guess I was wrong.
Is this yours?
Yeah.
Boy, it says Nicholas Bowling, does that jive? Who you are? Yeah, it's your name, good, we got it. You look a little unsure of that. And so Jay quit, I guess, which was fortunate because we don't have a seat for her or him anyway.
Jay graded my quiz last week.
Really? Well, they took the quiz too and did reasonably well, but.
What the heck?
I don't know if she quit, I think she was just in the car.
Oh, that's right,
I got that note. Sounded pretty bad.
Yeah, she had like mobile.
What?
Jesus.
What happened, you know?
How can you
I don't know, in the picture it looked like she got T-boned like right on the driver's side.
Somebody hit her,
yeah.
An intersection of some sort.
Yeah, I don't know so much about it, but it looks like.
Woof.
Bad news.
Well, that's certainly a legitimate reason for not being here. Alrighty. So we're going to continue on our discussion about history to bring this thing up to date and give you some idea of all the various factors that are closing in on American businesses. Internationally. So we've gotten to sort of the Industrial Revolution and the fact that in order to protect themselves, employees were unionizing. Right? And of course, over a period from about 1840 through 1935, so basically 100 years, during that 100-year period of time, when employees were trying to protect themselves by unionizing, and then after they were able to unionize in the 1930s, they pushed to have laws to protect them activated. So we had a huge battle here over that 100-year period between 1840 and 1935-ish, right, in which management, company owners, businesses, and the like, right, fought the concept that employees should be able to unionize, and fought the concept that they shouldn't use children to work in the plants, and fought the concept of any kind of regulation as to what they could do. And it was quite a long and bloody, and I do mean indeed bloody battle, as unions attempted to protect employees and companies hired strike breakers, which often meant breaking people's heads with baseball bats and the like. And we had a number of very violent strikes and reactions by employers to those strikes. A lot of people were killed, shot, gassed by the Pinkertons or by factory security, i.e. thugs, who came up and beat up people. Trying to feel that if they beat up 100 people, nobody in the country would be interested in unions anymore, which obviously was not the case. So during this period of then 1845, and I use that because there was a particular Supreme Court case then, which I won't burden you with, that allowed employees the right to unionize. For a while, the plant owners were saying, well, you know, it's a monopoly. They have all the work, and they're monopolizing the work, and they shouldn't be able to by unionizing. But that didn't cut it. So in 1845, I'll mention the case, but I doubt if I'll ever ask you about it. It's called Commonwealth versus Teal. Commonwealth versus Teal established the legal right for people to unionize and form unions to protect themselves. This came all the way forward to 1935 with the National Labor Relations Act, the National Labor Relations Act here in the U.S., which spelled out the nature of the protection that unions had, what companies could do and what they couldn't do. They couldn't fire employees that had unionized, et cetera, et cetera. So this period then was growing protection for employees. It's important to know that, but it's also important to realize what the attitude was here. the attitude between employers and employees. This employer-employee relationship remained during this period of time, that versus relationship that I told you about. It was not one team working together to try to bring job satisfaction, so to speak, to the employees while turning out a price-competitive product that met the needs of customers in the market. That was not what it was. It was the companies trying to force employees into a mold that they wanted them to be in. And that mold was essentially act like a machine. Don't give us any trouble. Do what's supposed to be done. Just be a machine. And, of course, as you know, as well as I know, as well as they knew, that kind of work gets extremely tedious and extremely boring. It was extremely dangerous, too, since a machine doesn't need to be protected. These people often weren't protected. Are you going to ask me a question?
Would you say that was the golden age of capitalism, which allowed some individuals to become extremely wealthy, like John D. Rockefeller? By the time he retired, his net worth was estimated at $660 billion.
Which was a lot of money. But in today's dollars. Well, would that be the golden age of capitalism? Depends, I guess, on how you define capitalism and whether or not you define it as being wealth accumulation or national growth. You know. So depending on how you wanted to define it, I would not think of it as the golden age of capitalism per se, because it was just too laissez-faire. It couldn't endure, in my opinion. You could not endure treating employees essentially like cattle. And not only was it a bad thing, but the historic writing talks about a living wage, and people weren't getting a living wage. And if they weren't getting a living wage, what good does it do you as an industrialist to build, you know, 10 million cars if nobody out there has the money to buy them? And Ford, Henry Ford, before he went nuts, raised everybody's pay to, I think maybe it was $10 a day, though it might have been $5. It was considered to be a lot of money at the time, and principally he did that because he wanted them to have enough money to go out and buy one of their cars. Kind of interesting. So what we see then is, while it looked like in some ways the people who were getting the money, right, would see that as the golden age of capitalism, I think from a national point of view, which is what the other view would be, is that it was a low point. And I would say that strengthening unions, more power for employees to get a living standard so that they could spend money, take vacations, raise kids that, you know, were going to be something more than just slaves, was a better situation. But again, it depends on how you define it. The Rockefellers might define that as indeed the golden age. Don't know. So in any case, we had this battle until they established these rights to unionize. Still, there were many conflicts between management and unions. Though this is not a principal area, but I want you to know about this stuff, the long history of trying to suppress employees has a long and bloody history here in this country as well as in many other countries. So we come forward here to where unions are fairly well established, and they begin to have clout in the nature of the regulations that are written. So we have wage and hours, workplace safety considerations, so hours, how many hours you can work, minimum wage considerations. All this stuff is pushed by the unions. And I won't go into any huge detail on this, because that's not the focus of the course. So we had lots of new laws to protect employees, namely the National Labor Relations Act and the various changes that happened to it in two major incidents in the future. So now we arrive in the 1960s here. We're getting these new laws to protect employees, but we're also getting laws to protect the citizens. At work. And so these are the societal rules that were put in place to protect employees. So the first laws were to protect employees per se. So these are safety, child labor, pay, and unionization, amongst others. There's probably many more that we could think of should we sit down over a couple beers and talk about it. Then we had laws to protect the citizens as they go into work, and these would be particularly the civil rights laws that developed during the 1960s. We have the Equal Pay Act, we have the Civil Rights Act, and we're going to talk about these at some length. Civil Rights Act of 1965, and we have affirmative action, 1964. And we have affirmative action, which was essentially 1965 plus. So these are laws that protect people coming into the workplace, which was a big change. We had very few federal laws, you know, set in Washington that protected all employees in all workplaces, interestingly enough. Mostly they were focused on safety at work in a certain industry. Here's how this industry has to be made safe by doing this and that. So it was industry focused. But in the 60s, we moved away from this industry specific laws here and moved instead into these more social laws that impacted all of society as a whole.
So equal rights in the middle was important, right?
Pardon?
You said equal rights in the
middle?
Right.
No, I'll.
Equal pay.
Equal pay.
Oh.
Sorry. Equal Pay Act. That's a P, not an R. The Equal Pay Act. Equal Pay Act is 1963, but it's, I'm not going to go into that right now. It's based on an earlier law. Okay. Now, to what degree do these things impact you today? They impact you to a great deal today. These decisions, I probably mentioned to you before, can be very expensive for companies to solve after they've gone through a court situation. And, of course, there's negative PR associated with a whole bunch of these things. If you get in trouble with the Civil Rights Act or something with the Equal Pay Act where women are being paid less than men or some such. So we have a lot of both costs, tangible costs, but we also have public relations problems. You also, of course, have one other problem, briefly. I won't want to go into this at any great length. When you take a employment pool of qualified people, here are all the qualified people that are in this workforce, I'm just putting Q's in here, and you say, I'm only going to hire men, what happens to your qualified applicant pool? Take a large guess. If you decide you're not hiring half the population because of its gender, what happens to the size of that pool? It's cut in half. It's truncated by the number of people you are, right off the bat, eliminating regardless of qualification. So what you're doing is cutting this in half. And if you have any other kind of non-job related characteristic, you're going to make the pool even smaller. What happens when you make the pool smaller? As it gets smaller and smaller, what are your chances of getting the most qualified person? You're making the pool smaller by discriminating against these people based on what we call protected group status, gender, race, religion, blah, blah. What happens to the number of qualified people that you would be able to hire? It gets smaller. What's your chance of getting the very best person who might have been available to you when you first started the process? Pardon?
Very slim.
It's very slim. The most qualified person could have been a woman, could have been a Hispanic, could have been a Muslim, who knows what. So we have all kinds of people being eliminated, so your possibility of getting the best person is truncated, as I said. And when you're truncating the market, the labor market like this, you're automatically building in inefficiencies, obviously. So you're building in willingness to take less qualified people. What else happens? If we're all sitting in this room here and I decide to close the door and start pumping the air out of the room, How much are you beginning to want to be interested in paying me for air?
More.
And would you expect the price on air to be going up reasonably quickly? Okay. What happens then when you start getting rid of qualified people and you get it down to the guy with the straight blonde hair, the wire-rimmed glasses that's 6 feet, 1 inch tall and went to Princeton? What's going to be the cost of hiring that guy or gal or whoever? Guy in this case. The cost is going to be low because he's desperate for a job, or the cost because it's diminishing the supply is going to be high. Take a guess. Because you don't have anybody else. You're stuck within your parameters of only being interested in hiring white males from Princeton. You're going to have a limited applicant pool. They're going to know it, and they're going to demand more money. So you're going to pay more for less quality. Kind of stupid, isn't it? Say yes, Dr. Fox. Kind of stupid, isn't it?
Yes, Dr. Fox.
Thank you. I'm glad we're all awake still. But the reality is that for years, and even today, we see this being the case. Did you know that the average CEO is 3 inches or 4 inches taller than the average employee at the organization?
Because he sees over everyone.
Pardon?
Because he sees over everyone.
I guess he sees over everyone. But he's taller and more impressive. Taller people, for some reason, get the nod in terms of leadership. Don't ask me why. Are they necessarily more qualified? You're taller, obviously. But of course they're not, right? They're just people who happen to be taller due to some genetic proclivity. Who knows why?
I think in general, short people are actually more smart because they have to learn how to make their bodies work more efficient.
I don't know enough about the physics of this to respond to that.
He's like 5'2" in my economics class, and we all failed it, and he made 100.
Well, don't get me sidetracked on this, baby. One of my pet peeves, you know what one of my pet peeves is about American students? Is that in any class, I don't want to embarrass her, it's the foreigners that always get the top grades. If there's foreigners in the class, it ain't going to happen for you guys. And that's the truth, be it Chinese, be it, I had two girls from Uruguay a couple years ago. It's unbelievable.
And they can all speak multiple languages.
Yeah.
It's automatic.
Many, many languages. Three, four languages. It's phenomenal. Foreign students are unbelievable, regardless of how tall they are. So, what we're looking at here then is these laws that not only protect the citizenship, but also essentially require companies to look inclusively in the market to find the best people rather than the people that happen to suit the stereotypical image of who you want to hire. All right, so that sort of moved us up into the 60s. Then, of course, as we moved into the 70s and beyond, we had more and more foreign competition, which required more and more savvy on the parts of the organization to get the best people and to focus on what was needed at a company. So what we're looking at here with foreign competition is companies that are based overseas that have cost advantages, cheaper labor, et cetera, maybe have material advantages. We don't have any bauxite for aluminum here in this country, for example. So what we're looking at here is a lot more intense competition for goods, somewhat less on services, but certainly a lot of goods are being outsourced, of course, to save money. And if companies want to stay in business here in the U.S., they have to make very efficient use of the resources that they have. I told you about my student that's bringing work back to Kentucky. Kentucky. I told you about that. I'm really interested to see if he can make this happen. It's going to be close. So, all in all, then, all of this is building to the fact that HR has more and more relevance to the ongoing success of the organization and to the ongoing goal achievement of an organization at the appropriate time one to time two transition. So we help by getting them there, as, of course, do marketing and accounting, finance, and all the other functional areas. But we have a long road to haul because we've been doing things wrong from a human resources point of view for 150 years at least in our history. Whereas accountants and finance people, I think, have learned a little more quickly about how to do things right. Okay, so with all of that in mind, therefore, we are going to spend a good bit of time this year, this semester, I guess I should say, talking about how companies need to be cognizant of various costs that they're running up without even realizing it, that make them less and less competitive in a global economy. And it's kind of a scary topic, but I figure the more you know about it, the better. You can hopefully address some of the issues. Okay, I talked originally now at time one about the company doing an environmental scan. The environmental scan is done under the view of the mission statement's umbrella here, right, to figure out what kind of goals we should be set based on the various opportunities, weaknesses, threats, and strengths, and the like, that might be available out there in the environment being scanned. And the goal is established, right, and the transitions are being made. And from a human resources point of view, which is where we're going for this semester, from the human resources point of view, we have a, I want to say planopy, you know, a whole range of considerations of what needs to be fine-tuned, done correctly, in order for the company to make best use of its people. The problem is, of course, that before we can make the best use of our people, we have to undo so many things that we think we know and so many things that we innately think are right and how things are done, right? If you're faced with an imminent disaster, for example, a buffalo is charging at you through the jungle. No, are there buffaloes in the jungle? A tiger is charging at you through the jungles in, would have to be India, wouldn't it? Aren't tigers only in India? What? There's tigers other places? Siberia. I think you're right. An orange tiger is charging towards you. There, I got you. The hell with your Siberian tigers. All right, so one of these orange tigers is charging at you there in India. Are you going to be interested in taking matters into your hand, or do you want to put it to a manager or a committee to determine how you should respond to this threat? Take it into your own hands. Thank you for taking it into your own hands and leaping to that astute conclusion, or while everyone else was still thinking about what the committee could do for them. Right. And this is a very human response to difficulties. Take it into your hands, make it happen. Okay. The problem, of course, is how do I get you guys to unlearn that innate response that has kept humankind alive for all these years? Because when you're faced with a problem in a workplace situation, it's often a good idea to turn loose some control and start working with others to solve a problem, the employees, for example. So if something's going wrong, there's poor quality control, you're not getting the output that you want, employees are quitting, it would be a good idea rather than take tighter control by yourself, it would be a good idea to farm this out to the actual employees to try and find out what's going on that's unpleasant, why they're quitting, why they're not working, why they're setting fires out in the janitorial supply area, et cetera, et cetera. So the idea here is, from a human resources point of view, as we move into the semester, I have to move you away from many of your predetermined decisions on who's going to be good at what. This, for example, played out very much when we were looking at early on in the Civil Rights Act of women wanting to be police officers. What do you think happened? They got shouted down in large part because they were being too feminine. and they couldn't punch people out, which, of course, is a major aspect of being a policeman, or beat somebody over the head with a truncheon until they were semi-unconscious on the ground because they had torn up their parking ticket. So what we had here was seeing women as innately unable to do the job of being a policeman or a fireman. I always hope it's more pictures, but it's always something about credit cards. All right, so what we're looking at here is the idea of undoing our brain. Can women be police officers now? All of you nod yes. We all know that. We've gotten tickets from a wide variety of genders across the years. No problem there. I expect police dogs to be pretty soon issuing tickets. I'll get one from a police dog at some point. Arf, 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 sign here. Okay, or I'll bite your hand. Okay, I'll sign, et cetera. So these kinds of immediate responses need to be changed. Can women be firemen? Yes, they run them through the usual tests that they have firemen do, move a ladder, carry a baby down, right? Whatever, leap off a burning building, whatever people have to do to be a fireman. And surprisingly enough, they can do it too. All right, so we have to break these habits, and they're really hard to break because most of us feel that they're correct. That's why we do them, right? Or we've been told that that's what it is. We know that there are certain jobs that are men and certain jobs that are women, et cetera. So that needs to be broken in order to get the best people. All right, so from the human resources point of view, we really understand that we need to keep the our pool of applicants and the like large. So moving forward with human resources then is the HR strategy. Which, of course, is going to be essentially to find the right person in the right place for the job, right? To get the right person into the jobs that are required out here at time two, our goal out here, has certain required jobs, certain required behaviors, certain required skills and abilities that we want to get. And in general, if we were thinking about staffing an organization in its new role as goal achieving over there, where would we look first for our individual employees that we needed, various skills over there? Where would we look for these people? Before even we got to that, what could we do? Yeah, look at the people already you have. Maybe you have people that are completely qualified for this job. So we have jobs over here that we might be able to fill internally. Right. We could post this job, which means we put up notices for people to do a particular job, and that posting is available for people who are working for us now to look at. What's the advantage of this? What's the advantage of posting for internal job applicants? They're familiar with the company, the way things are done, at least the culture of the organization. They know a lot of the connectors, who does what, who to go to talk to if they have a particular issue with something that the work requires, et cetera. Sure. What else?
You've already approved them once.
Technically, they could still be qualified for the new job, assuming the new job isn't too different. So there's a possibility there. Keep going. This should have been something you talked about in OB.
You don't have to waste time searching for someone else.
I'm not sure waste is the right word. You wouldn't have to use time searching for a person if you could find somebody who was totally capable of doing the job internally.
The cost is lower?
Cost is lower because you don't have to recruit. And the selection system might be somewhat different, but we're still missing a point.
We get along with everyone?
We would hope they get along with everyone. What is going to be the positive, aside from all this stuff that you guys are mentioning, which are certainly valid reasons that I would have written down if I were you, but what's the thing that you haven't mentioned, which is a prime consideration in an organization's culture?
You keep jobs in-house, other people want to work for you.
Yeah, and that's called morale in large part. And the idea that you can move up through promotions in an organization, move to a slightly different job, you have a future with this organization because people that work for us stay with us. That kind of thing. So there's a morale issue associated with this too. And if we're building an organization that's going to be able to be competitive, we need to have everything possible going for us. Everything. Which is to say, make good use of morale. I encourage you all to read cases on this kind of thing. Pfeffer's case on Southwest Air. Southwest Air entered into competition with Continental and completely decimated them. Why? Because of their interaction with their own employees and how they build up employees, employee satisfaction, how looking after employees, employees having a good time on the job and wanting to work for that company allowed them to pay pilots half of what Continental had to pay, because the pilots that worked at Continental hated the job, but they would be glad to do it for $200,000. Where the employees at Southwest were happy to work the job, they got stock in the company, and it was fun being there, so they would take half of that pay, $100,000. So this idea of building up a strong, happy workforce is an amazingly potent tool for competing. And companies sort of found this out. So offering jobs internally is a good start on figuring out how to staff the positions that we're going to have out here at Time 2. Now, please remember that the goals may require just a small change, right? Delta means change, right? Can mean a small change, or a goal can mean a large change. And obviously in a large change, there would be, it would seem like there would be more demand for new employees or employees relocated, et cetera, et cetera. But in any case, whatever this change is out here, it's wise, in my opinion, to search internally for the best qualified applicants to sort of start building this morale that I was just talking about. Okay, so we could post internally, job posting, which essentially is exactly what it says. You take a piece of paper, you write out the job description, more on that later, the job specifications, which is what's required of your background in order to do it. You put it up on a bulletin board, and people sign up to be interviewed or be considered for this particular job. Job posting is a common way of filling openings that are coming up in an organization, either for normal people quitting and leaving, or for new positions that are opening up because of goal changes or goal augmentation. So we have job postings for internal hires. Then, of course, we could also go externally. Externally, into the external labor market to try to find the right people to fill jobs. Think of all the things you need to know to go externally, much more than you might need for just a pop job posting. You would need to know, for example, what we call the relevant labor market. Relevant, not relative. Relevant, in other words, the germane, the appropriate. The relevant labor market. The relevant labor market is, you hear that pause? That's so you can write a colon. The relevant labor market is, colon, the geographic area from which you expect to draw a certain level of employees. So, if you are looking to hire a new director of marketing, how big a geographic area would you consider when you're looking for that head of marketing?
The same geographical area as your market, I would say, so they know it. I mean, it depends.
Yeah. What we're looking for here is a highly important position to fill, right? And so we certainly wouldn't want to truncate the relevant labor market. We would want to look fairly inclusively. But let's say you were hiring for director of marketing here at ASU. Would you only hire in North Carolina, for example?
No.
What would you want to do? You'd want to find a person who's done this kind of work before, and you would probably look at least nationally, if not internationally, to try and find the best person. The higher up in the organization you look for a position to fill, the larger your relevant labor market, the geographic area from which you expect to draw a certain level of employee. The larger the area gives you a better chance of filling an important position in the organization. Okay? So that's the concept of the relevant labor market. It's extremely important because we're going to talk about it a lot when we get to equal employment and the various protective laws. All right, and affirmative action too, of course. So what we're looking at here then as we start to hire is how difficult is the job? So we're looking at these expanding, they're not round necessarily, who knows what their shape are, but the relevant labor market is that geographic area from which we expect to draw a certain level of employees, and quite often at the lower levels is how far people are willing to travel to get to the job each day. So if you have a lower level job, people aren't willing to drive 300 miles to and fro work, 600 miles a day, in order to work at a job that pays $10 an hour. So it's that geographic area. On the other hand, if you're hiring a new director of marketing and you find somebody in California, they might fly to Charlotte and relocate. But you're not going to do that with a laborer. So the geographic area that we have to consider depends on the level of the job in the organization, and we want to saturate that relevant labor market with advertising, word of mouth, contacts that people might have, saturate that area with information about the job that's available. Now, of course, now we have a lot of this that people just post online, and people make their own decisions about whether or not they're willing to travel to take the job. But the concept remains the same in large part. Certain bulletin boards are better for certain types of work than other bulletin boards, for example, electronic bulletin boards. Okay, so the relevant labor market then is where we're going to search. And if we're going to advertise inclusively across that for a head of marketing versus somebody who's going to come and dig a trench for us around the garden area so we can put a pipe in at our place of business, they're going to be completely different. How big's the relevant labor market for a trench digger?
Very small.
Very small. How far people would be willing to drive. You want to hear my trench joke about the guys working in the trench? You can take this home, we can use it. These two guys are digging a trench, and they really hate it, it's hot, they can't stand it. And so one guy says to the other, how come we're down here digging, the boss gets to drive around the air-conditioned Escalade? And I said, I don't know. Let's ask him next time. So they hear this a little while later, this silent car pulling up. The boss is lowering the window to look around, see what's going on. Go ask him. So one guy climbs up out of the trench, goes to ask the boss. The boss puts the window back down again. What? He says, we want to know what we have to dig, and you get to drive around in the Escalade with the air conditioning on. The boss says, because you're stupid. Stupid. The boss says, okay, I'm going to show you once, and I don't want to have to do this again. So he lumbers out of the car, and he says, go ahead, hit my hand. And the worker says, oh, boy, this is my chance. So he takes a huge swing at that guy's hand. The guy at the last second drops his hand, and the worker plows his fist into a tree that's behind his hand. Nice. God, see, you're stupid. Get back down there and start digging. And the guy goes back down his trench and says, okay, how come we got to dig? How come we got to dig? And I said, because we're stupid. The guy says, what do you mean we're stupid? He says, okay, go ahead, hit my hand. It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not bad. You know a better ditch digging joke? Probably not. I like it. Okay. So anyway, this relevant labor market idea is the difference between hiring, unskilled labor from the local area, basically, versus a higher ranked, probably more skilled job in the organization. And saturating the area so that you can find, with advertising of some form or fashion, so that you can expect to find the highest quality person interested in working for your company. You need high quality people. There's so much behind this decision. We'll talk about that when we get the compensation and benefits and those kinds of things as well. But for the time being, that best person has to be at least moving into the applicant pool from which somebody will be hired. Well, we're not going to talk about how we go about hiring because that's a selection issue, and we have two or three lectures on selection. But we're going to take somebody out of the applicant pool. We're going to hire them. After they're hired, what do we have to do? What would you say? Training and orientation. Orientation, getting used to the place, learning what they get, who to talk to when they need something, where's the cafeteria, etc. Orientation and training. So this becomes a unit that we need to talk about. This is selection here that we're going to talk about. After training, we train the people. They take over the job. Right. What do we have to consider? Well, obviously, we have to consider pay, benefits. So that's another unit there that has to be done. We have performance appraisal. I'll just put PA there so that we can talk to them about what's going wrong and what's going right, and make the changes as needed. Then we have, of course, the overall concern about health and safety across the plant, how we keep a safe plant, and then terminations and discipline, those kinds of things. So we have these various units here that need to be discussed. And all of it comes to the bottom line of having the best possible HR processes for our company to get to where it needs to go. I'm saying, overall, you should have an awareness of the type of employee that you want.
Sorry, under training, what is that, pay and what?
Benefits.
Benefits, okay, sorry.
So what we're looking for here, in my opinion, before you start in on this process, you need to, of course, consider your goal and the positions that have to be filled. But even before that, back here, and in any number of, hang on, my archaeologist sister. Hi, sis. Yes, I'm in class now. Say hi to my sister.
Hey.
That's my class saying hello to you. Yeah, so I'll get back. Are you at home? Well, I'll just call you on your cell here in a while, okay? Good, I'll call you in the middle of your class. All right, I love you. I'll talk to you later, okay? Bye. She's totally cool. She's off in class or something. Teaching kids how to swim and look for things underwater. How cool is that? She probably doesn't, but that's kind of rude, don't you think? Anyway, some sort of, oh my God, this is great. That's an accident. She doesn't really need to call me back. Is this an accident? Or she's embarrassed. She won't answer. So, I'll end the call there. All right. So, all of this here is part of it. But where I was before I got rudely interrupted by my sister is we were born on the same day. Isn't that amazing? But 12 years apart or something. Something like that. Not the same day. That'd be twins. Or not twins.
Your mother was in labor for 12 years.
For 12 years, yeah. Or something like that. There's got to be some logical thought there. Before you enter into this, you should read about successful organizations today, and in large part, you can see it in yourself. What are you looking for in a job? Of course you want money. Of course you want a BMW convertible. Of course you want a trophy wife slash husband. Of course you want all the obvious things that I wanted when I was a kid too. And so you have to decide, is the place that I'm going to work for going to supply all the things I need? But one of the things you need is a supportive, growing environment where you become worth more. You have upward mobility. You have input into the system. You can talk to people without a fear of being fired if you have a problem. It's what's known as compassionate organization. I've mentioned it to you before. That helps you grow. This does not mean the organization is wishy-washy and you can walk all over them, but it does mean that they're concerned about your growth within the organization and your ability to grow and help the organization. This is kind of a semi-new concept. There have been organizations like this around for a while, but limited numbers. And as competition gets worse and worse internationally, what I'm seeing is companies firing and acting more and more stupid in terms of how to get the most out of their employees. So what I'm saying is that as you start into this, you should keep in mind, my opinion is that from an OB point of view, you need to build a constructive, almost nurturing in relationship with your employees, so that the employees want to stay with you. You invest in them and they invest in you. Not you invest in them and they leave, or they invest in you and then they leave with the training that you put in them and they take that training to a competitor, etc. So you want to hold on to employees, and in order to do that, you have to meet the needs of them besides the BMW and the high salaries. Because there is, that's not quite true, but there's no reasonable salary that you'll ever get that will make up for the feeling you have waking up in the morning saying you hate the job. Mm-hmm. Take it from me.
Pardon? Like 14 people quit at Sunglass.
Say again?
We've had like 14 people quit at Sunglass.
Right. And that's exactly what it is. And when my wife was working, she worked at a place. She said to me once, if I don't see my manager, she's so smart. When I don't see my manager, it makes my day. When I see my manager, it ruins the week. I like that one a lot. And that's really a statement about a poor OB type of job placement, when you hate to see your manager. And don't construct an organization that does that, because you train people, you get them working, they know their job, and then as soon as possible, they quit. And the reality is, research indicates, the majority of people quit their jobs if you get rid of stuff like moving and having babies and those kinds of things. If you get rid of those things that are non-controllable, perhaps, then people leave their jobs because they dislike intensely their immediate supervisors. Interesting, isn't it? So, keep that kind of thing in mind as you start to go into this entire process here that we're going to go through. The entire process that we're going to go through is going to be efficient and effective for the organization. But if you have a bad relationship with your employees, it doesn't matter how efficient and effective you are, because the good people that you spent time hiring and paying, right, aren't going to be there. So try and mull that over. All right, that's enough for today, but be ready for another quiz on Thursday.